4 hours. So, yeah, that's where they are tonight. And Erica's the superstar. She's taking care of all three. But Layla's done great. She's actually learned how to do her own, puts it on her fingers, sticks it on her eye. And so she's been a little champ. So thank you for all your prayers, your text messages over the last month and a half checking on us. I don't know honestly when the last time all five of us were here at the same time. This evening, I told Andy this morning, I guess, this might not be my best lesson, but it's been kind of maybe the easiest lesson to put together. Because in our class that we're teaching in the back, with the 3rd, 4th, and 5th graders, big difference. Grant was with them before I went into the room, and he got basically the Israelites out of Egypt and all the way in through the wilderness and up to the plains of Moab. And then we've been studying the process of the Israelites entering Canaan's land and so on. And when we review this and review this kind of track record of history with them, we know that God made three promises to Abraham, and he reaffirmed these promises to him at least once. Then, when Abraham passes, he makes these same three promises to Isaac. Then, when Isaac passes, he makes the same three promises to Jacob. We know the story of Jacob's family, pretty dysfunctional, it looks like, and to the point where his son Joseph was sold at 17 into slavery in Egypt. And all of this was part of God's plan because of these promises he had made originally to Abraham. Well, time goes by, there's a famine, Jacob's other sons show up in Egypt, and there's Joseph, who has risen from the bouts of slavery to one of the most prominent positions in all the land, and is in a position to either kill or save the very people who put him into slavery. And he chooses to show mercy and love and compassion. And so because of Joseph, he brings his family, his father he hasn't seen in ages. He brings him and all of his family to Egypt. And the Bible tells us in total, there were 70 people out of his family that came to Egypt. Joseph was there with him, his wife, his two sons. 430 years later, God brings Moses and the Exodus. You know, we sometimes refer to Exodus in terms of the book, but Exodus was an event. And so he brings Moses and the Exodus for the Israelites. And Numbers 1, verse 45 and 46, and 2 and verse 32 gives us an idea of God fulfilling the first of those three promises, because he told Abraham, I'm going to make you a great nation. Well, 70 go in, and Joseph's family makes 74. And 430 years later, out comes 603,550 fighting men, 20 years of age and older. And as we also know, this doesn't include the Levites, which God told Moses not to run the census on. It doesn't include women. It doesn't include children. So what we see is through God's divine plan, 70 was incubated into easily a million. God took his people on a journey. He took them overland, and we often say overseas, but God didn't take them overseas. He took them through the sea, because he let them walk on the dry land underneath the water. The story of the Israelites, as we all know, is filled with complaining and unbelief, disobeying. And because of that, they spent 40 extra years in the wilderness, due to their disbelief. When it came time to send the spies in, they said, no, we can't do it. And after those 40 years, they come up to the plains of Moab. And they are on the eastern side of the Jordan River. They're getting ready to go in, and Moses dies, and Joshua takes charge. So that is the history that our six young people in the class that Grant taught, and then I'm teaching right now, that we have gone through so far. And tonight I want to share with you some lessons from the Israelites. When we started our class 8 weeks ago, we didn't start with the Israelites. We actually went ahead of a number of years to the Psalms. And we pulled Psalm 19, which says, "The law of the Lord is perfect, restoring the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether." And the observation that we made in our class was how much better, because this hasn't ever changed about God. That, what David may have written it after the Israelites entered the Promised Land, but this has been true from day one with God. It's true of God today. But how much better would the lives of the Israelites have been if they had thought of this and remembered it and recognized God for who He was, and not only as God, but who He was as their God, their protector, as their guide through the wilderness. How much better would our lives be if we did the same thing? And so, that's where we began our class. One of the very first things we talked about with these six young people was Psalm 19 and that idea. And we've come back to that a couple of times so far in the last 8 weeks. But tonight, we want to share some points with you about and some lessons from the Israelites, starting with, don't be greedy, be honest. Well, that's kind of two different things. Yeah. But we've grouped some ideas together, because have you ever met a greedy person who's also fully honest? Have you ever met an honest person who doesn't demonstrate greed in some ways? Because my experience tells me dishonesty is usually driven in part by greed, by selfishness, by selfish ambition, by the desire to have my way, regardless of what the right way is. And think of, and when we think of being honest, think of the city of Ai and the story of Achan that we read about in Joshua 7, chapter 7 and 8. Before we get there, understand that when we go to Joshua 6, and they're getting ready to cross the river Jordan and go into the Promised Land, their first city is Jericho, and God puts a ban on Jericho for the Israelites. He says, anything that's gold, silver, iron, and I forgot the fourth one, yeah, and bronze, that goes all to the Lord's treasury. You destroy everything, but anything made of those four things, that goes to the Lord's treasury. Well, they do that. And they get through Jericho, and they get to the city of Ai and Achan and in Joshua 7 and 8. And so Joshua sends spies up to Ai, and not knowing of Achan's sin. And the spies come back, oh, we only need a few thousand people for this. It's going to be easy. He has 603,000 men. We only need three for Ai. And what we learn about is that Ai pushed back on the Israelite army that went up there, and 36 Israelites died in that battle. In verse 18, we read of Achan's sin being publicly revealed by God. And when confronted with the truth, this is where some honesty comes in. When confronted with the truth, it was good of Achan to say, I have sinned against God. I have sinned against the Lord. So he was honest about his guilt. And I think we can give him at least that credit right there. But a few weeks ago when Pax was preaching about Josiah, what did we read about in Josiah doing in 2 Kings 22 and 23? He went through and he cleaned up all the filth and rot and sin that was in the kingdom. Even going so far as pulling up the bones out of the ground and burning them. Well, we can see the first example of that right here. Because God tells Joshua, you take Achan, you take his family, you take this all his belongings, even his animals, you take them up out of the camp of Israel, you stone them, and you get rid of them. You destroy them. And that's exactly what they did. The consequences of greed and dishonesty are here in this life, but they're also in eternity. And they don't, and we also see that the consequences don't also apply just to us, do they? They apply here to Achan's family, to his belongings, the animals, but they also applied to the 36 soldiers who lost their lives at the first battle of Ai, and their families, and their sorrow. So, lesson number one, don't be greedy, be honest. But let's take that word honest a little bit differently as well. We talked about Achan. Let's talk about the 10 plagues of Egypt. Exodus 7 verses through Exodus 11. The Israelites were there for that. They saw that. They were there at the Exodus from Egypt. In Exodus 12 and verse 41. If you go to Exodus 12 verse 41, here's what you're going to see. And it's and you can't make this up. This is not circumstance. It's not, oh wow, I didn't realize that. Exodus 12 and verse 41, and at the end of 430 years to the very day, all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. 430 years to the day that those 70 members of and their 70 ancestors went into Egypt, they came out of Egypt. So, 10 plagues of Egypt, I can kind of say, oh, you know, today we'd say global warming or something like that. Oh, it's the weather change. That's why we got all these bugs going around. Exodus from Egypt, 430 years. Oh, that's just coincidence. Okay. Okay. We can rationalize maybe the weather, maybe the animals, that kind of stuff. We can maybe even call it coincidence, even though that's not what I believe in. But what about pillars of cloud and fire? They're being led and guided by pillars of cloud and fire. In Exodus 13, verses 21 and 22. What about being faced with the most advanced army with chariots coming at your backside and you've got a sea in front of you and you've got one of two choices? Well, you can either drown or you can go back to slavery and be killed. Well, there's also the third choice, the right choice, God's choice, and that's the Red Sea crossing. And they were there for that. Let's just be honest. The Israelites were there at the 10 plagues. They saw God's handiwork there. They saw and knew their history. They knew that they were leaving Egypt just as they had been told they would. They saw the pillars of cloud and fire. They saw God's handiwork with the Red Sea crossing. And it wasn't just, hey, there's a dam or there's a bridge. We're going to cross over this little stream. No, there's two walls of water with dry ground in the middle. They saw that. And when they do get past the Red Sea, they go into the wilderness and their first complaint, we don't have water. God takes care of that real quick, doesn't he? Well, we don't have food. All of a sudden they have food. Well, okay, we have food, but we don't have meat. God takes care of that. They were there for every step of the way. And then we get to Mount Sinai, Exodus 19. And if you look at Exodus 19 and verses 16 through 20, we might be able to rationalize the plagues a little bit. We just came out of pandemic mode. We might rationalize and call it coincidence on the date that they left Egypt. I don't see how they can rationalize and excuse all these other things. And especially when you get to Exodus 19 and get them down to Mount Sinai. And so we're going to go back to about verse 14. So Moses went down from the mountain to the people and consecrated the people, and they washed their garments. He said to the people, "Be ready for the third day. Do not go near a woman." So it came about on the third day when it was morning that there were thunder and lightning flashes and a thick cloud upon the mountain and a very loud trumpet sound, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled. And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was all in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire, and its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked violently. When the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him with thunder. They were there for that. How can you say, "I'm an honest person," and ignore 10 plagues of Egypt, the historical fact of leaving on the same day your ancestors went in, the pillars, the Red Sea crossing, your needs being met, and a God who answers his spokesperson not with words, but with thunder? What we see time and time again from the Israelites is their ignorance, and it's willful ignorance. It's actual negligence on their part. They were denying God because they were so self-absorbed, so greedy to take care of themselves, that they'd rather go back to Egypt than put their trust in God. And they had already, just in a matter of days, had all these visible reasons to believe. We need to have faith in God. Don't worship idols. Makes sense? The Israelites grew up around idolatry, but they knew their history and who God was. And when Moses and Aaron went to them in Exodus, the fourth chapter, they reminded them of that. And Aaron did the signs that Moses had been told by God to do. And when the elders of the Israelites saw it, they said, "We believe." And they bowed down and they worshiped. And they were glad to hear that God had heard their moanings and their groanings of being in affliction. God told Israel to keep his commandments, and they said they would. You know, I can claim ignorance on a lot of things because I'm not that smart. And if I don't know it, I can play the ignorance card real easy. "I'm sorry, I didn't know. I really didn't. I'm so sorry." But God told his people. They knew their history. He told them again to keep his commandments. And they even said, "We will do it." When you look at Exodus 19 and verses 5 through 6 and verse 8, "Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." And you go down to verse 8, "All the people answered together and said, 'All that the Lord has spoken, we will do.'" That was their reply. They knew it. They knew what they should do. But we see just how shallow their faith is coming up. We see that God issued his Ten Commandments to them in Exodus 20. He even told them in the first five verses of Exodus 20. What? "Whatever, do whatever you want. I just set you free, but do whatever you want." No. Then God spoke all these words saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven or above or on earth beneath or in the water underneath the earth. You shall not worship them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and the fourth generations of those who hate me. Don't have anyone else besides me. How did Israel respond? Well, later on, when Moses doesn't come back as quickly as they would like, some Israelites go to Aaron to go, make us a god. No, I'm not doing that, is what Aaron replied, right? No. He said, okay, give me your gold. And when Moses confronted him later, what did he say? Oh, I just threw it in the oven, the furnace, and it just popped out a gold calf. You know, idols pull away at one's faith. And when we talk about idols, yeah, we have this mental image of a golden calf or a statue or something of that sort. But an idol can be anything. It could be your job. It could be your livelihood. It could be the money that you make. And here they're bowing down and worshiping a man-made object. And it's because Israel failed to trust God's ability despite what he had done for them. And we see that when they go up and they send the spies into Canaan. And out of the 12 spies, only Joshua and Caleb come back. Joshua and Caleb says, yeah, we can do it. And the 10 say, nope, too much, can't do it. Totally ignoring everything that they had seen, everything that they had heard and witnessed, they failed to put their trust in God. They'd rather put their trust back into the idols and the comfort of the life they knew in Egypt as a slave. Before entering Canaan, God told Israel to destroy it all. Numbers 33:51-53. And when we look at that, it's interesting to note one thing right there. These pages are so thin. He tells them, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you cross over the Jordan into the land, then you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you, and destroy all their figured stones, and destroy all their molten images, and demolish all their high places. And you shall take possession of the land and live in it, for I have given the land to you to possess it. But here's what's also important to note. Verse 55, the warning here in verse 55. But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then it shall come about that those whom you let remain of them will become as pricks in your eye and as thorns in your sides, and they will trouble you in the land in which you live. Years ago, when I was about 17, I was on a framing crew one summer, and I was passing a 2x6 up to the guy up on the second floor, and he accidentally jerked the 2x6 out of my hand too hard and put a splinter right through the palm of my hand. And it was deep too, and I couldn't get it. I mean, it literally just sat there. And it bled and bled. And about a week later of it being in there, I looked down and it had festered. That's what leaving sin and temptation. That's what God was telling them here. When you leave something there, it will fester. It will grow. It will metastasize. It will cause you problems in ways you don't understand. God told them,
destroy it all. Get a clean slate going. And he warned them. And sometimes we're afraid to do that. We're afraid that we're going to lose what we do have right now. But notice what Jesus said in Matthew the 16th chapter, verses 24 through 27. He says, if anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself. And you must take up your cross. You must follow me. He's telling them, get your house in order. Get your priorities straight. You want to serve God, you have to put me first. Because that's sure not what the Israelites did. Whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? We also need to learn from the Israelites that you can trust the Lord to take care of you. Deuteronomy 6, verse 5. I promise you, if I asked any of those six kids what Deuteronomy 6 and verse 5 says, they would be able to, and I'm very proud of them for being able to say this, they could tell you exactly what it says, because we also sing a song about it. It says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. Love breeds trust. Trust breeds love. If we love God, if we say we love God, we will trust the Lord to take care of us because He has promised to do so. They had the Red Sea crossing where they were saved. Exodus 14. No water, no food, no meat, taken care of. He took care of them. Joshua 6, we get over to Joshua and read what, if you want to turn to it, Joshua 6 and verse 1 and 2 says, now Jericho was tightly shut because of the sons of Israel. No one went out and no one came in. Notice what the Lord said to Joshua in verse 2. See, I have given Jericho into your hand with its king and the valiant warriors. I'm not just giving you the city, I'm giving you the king of that city. The king and his valiant soldiers. The fighters. The people who know how to fight, who have experience fighting. I'm giving it all into your hand. They could have crossed that Jordan and been on their own. And, you know, Joshua had already sent spies in. That's a military tactic. You send spies in ahead of time to scout out the strengths and weaknesses of your opponent. Joshua had already done that. He knew what it was like. But here's what the Lord says. I have given Jericho into your hand. Once they rooted out the sin and the corruption of Achan and his family, notice what God says to Joshua and Joshua 8 and verse 1. Might sound familiar to you. Now the Lord said to Joshua, do not fear or be dismayed. Take all the people of war with you and arise. Go up to Ai. See, I have given into your hand the king of Ai, his people, his city, and his land. Once again, Joshua knew the strengths and weaknesses. They had already sent spies up there. But God says, it's yours. And what happens? The second battle of Ai, Ai falls. In Joshua, the 10th chapter, 9th and 10th chapter, we read about the Gibeonites fooling Israel, fooling Joshua. And notice what happens in Joshua 10. They come against five different kings. And in the process of that, God, in if I can flip the page here, these pages, wow. God, in chapter 10, verse 11, As they fled from before Israel, while they were at the descent of Beth Horon, the Lord threw large stones from heaven on them as far as Azekah, and they died. There were more who died from the hailstones than those whom the sons of Israel killed with the sword. That sound like God taking care of His people? Then look down another couple verses, the next verse or two. Then Joshua spoke to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the sons of Israel. And he said, in the sight of Israel, O sun, stand still at Gibeon, and O moon in the valley of Ajalon. So the sun stood still and the moon stopped until the nation avenged themselves of their enemies. Does that sound like God fighting for His people? When we look at Joshua, the 12th chapter, we get down to about verse 8, and we start reading about all the kingdoms that God delivered into the hands of Joshua and the Israelites. And in verse 24, and I like it. I love this part. Because the writer of Joshua right here says, the king of Jericho, one. The king of Ai, which is beside Bethel, one. The king of Jerusalem, one. And the list just keeps going. And the writer did this for a reason, I believe, because when you get down to verse 24, the king of Tirzah, one. In all, 31 kings. Joshua and the Israelites were delivered, 31 kings and their armies and their cities, by God. Matthew 6 and verse 25 through 23, it's easy to say, look at me, look at me. But we need to remember that we can trust the Lord to take care of us. Because as Jesus said, for this reason I say to you, do not be worried about your life, as Doug pointed out this morning, as to what you'll eat or what you'll drink, nor for your body as to what you'll put on. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothing? And I put the whole passage up there because it is filled with reasons not to worry. We need to remember to do everything the Lord commands and always obey God. To obey God even when it's hard. Why? Because He can do anything. Think about Moses at Meribah. We have two accounts of Moses and getting water from a rock. The first time, he is told to hit the rock. And he does, and the water comes out. Second time here at Meribah, he's told to speak to the rock. And instead, he hits it twice. What's his punishment? What's his consequence? You're not going into the promised land. Think about Rahab's faith. Rahab wasn't part of Israel. Not at first, but she knew enough and saw enough to have faith in Almighty God. And so she had faith enough to hide the spies. She had faith enough to let them go in peace. She had faith enough that when the time came for Israel to come against Jericho, she put the rope outside the window and brought her family in and shut the door. Think about the memorial that we read about in Joshua, the 4th chapter. When they crossed the Jordan River, God told Joshua to take one man from each tribe and to pick up a large stone and to build a memorial to God for this passage, for this crossing. And look down in Joshua, the 4th chapter, and in about verse 21, He said to the sons of Israel, when your children ask their fathers in time to come, saying, what are these stones? Then you shall inform your children, saying, Israel crossed this Jordan on dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan before you until you had crossed, just as the Lord your God had done to the Red Sea, which He dried up before us until we had crossed. that all the peoples of the earth may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty, so that you may fear the Lord your God forever. We need to not only do what God commands us, we need to remember that He can do anything. They have now seen twice His division of water from land. They saw the walls of Jericho fall. But God told Joshua in Joshua 6, very specific instructions on how to make sure that that happened. He said, march around the city once a day for 6 days. And on day 7, march around the city again. And all along the process, don't utter a single word. And when you come to the end of this whole marching process, then on the 7th day they rose early and they started their marches, and they did 7 times. So they marched around the city 13 times, not saying a word. What if Joshua got ambitious and thought to himself, you know what, I'm going to get us in a good spot. We're going to do 13 times in a day. We could do that. Or what about splitting half and half? We'll do 6 on Monday, 7 on Tuesday. That's not what God said. So, right here, we have Joshua setting the stage for the Israelites. He's setting the example. And when God says, march around once a day, don't utter a word, that's exactly what they do. When He says, march around the city on day 7 times, that's what they do. When He says, blow the ram's horns, that's what they do. Now, it's easy, as we've talked in the class, that it's easy to do that, to do the right thing, to do what God says when we're in the company of other Christians. But what about when there's pressure involved? What about when we are facing our friends at school or our colleagues at work? What about when someone cuts us off and we're tempted to say or do something we shouldn't? We need to remember the 1 Corinthians 10 verse 13 tells us, no temptation has overtaken us, but such as is common to man, and God's faithful, who will not allow us to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will provide the way of escape so that you will be able to endure it. We need to remember to ask advice from the Lord. Let's go back to Gibeon. In Joshua 9 verse 14, the Gibeonites got smart. They're there in the promised land, and they beat up their clothes and their gear a little bit. They show up to the camp, and they fooled Joshua and the Israelites into making an agreement with them, to make it a peace treaty with them. And notice what it says in Joshua, the 9th chapter, in verse 14. So the men of Israel took some of their provisions and did not ask for the counsel of the Lord. I think that may be one of the most dangerous things we could read. To not ask for the counsel of the Lord. Abraham went to God, and what God said, Abraham did. Isaac, do this. Isaac did it. Jacob, do this. Jacob did it. Moses went to God constantly, wanting to know how to serve God. Doug pointed out this morning about prayer. How much are we praying? That is us going to God, asking for His counsel, asking for His wisdom. We go to God for to thank Him. We go to God asking for forgiveness. But if we're going to ask for something else, let's ask for wisdom. Let's ask for His wisdom and His understanding so that we can make godly choices. Let's pray more than just at mealtime or when we rise up or when we're going to bed. Let's pray more than just when things are really, really good for us. Let's pray more than when it's just really bad for us. We need to go to God in all of these situations. At all of these times, we need to ask God for His counsel, for His wisdom. Because otherwise, we're destining ourselves for some failure, some circumstances that we shouldn't be in. That's what the Israelites found themselves. They made an agreement with the Gibeonites, despite being told, run all the people of the promised land out. Here they just made an agreement with some of those people. Because they did not ask for the counsel of the Lord. We're told, 1 Thessalonians 5:17, pray without ceasing. We're told, Philippians 4, verse 6, don't be anxious. Pray. Pray with supplication and thanksgiving. Let your requests be known to God. We have that opportunity any and every time we need it. John Lawrence was sitting in his high chair yesterday, and Erica's mopping the kitchen, and I'm walking through the living room, and he's putting his hands together and saying, we need to pray. And he goes, where's the food? And Eric and I both stopped and we're like, no, you can pray anytime you want for anything you need, and God will hear you. God, you can always go to God and talk to God. The formatting messed up. Yeah, it's okay. Joshua 21, verse 45. This is our most recent memory verse in our class. Not one of the good promises which the Lord had made to the house of Israel failed. All came to pass. God keeps His promises. He always keeps His promises. The three promises to Abraham that He made, He kept them. It didn't happen in the time span that the Israelites wanted or expected. He told them, I'll bring you out of Egypt. As a nation, He did it. They conquered the promised land about 1400 BC. That's a long time to hold and keep a promise. But God did it. God told Abraham, through your seed, all nations of the earth will be blessed. And what did God do? He sent His only Son to this earth. And His Son lived a life of absolute perfection. He fulfilled every single prophecy made about the Messiah. He died a sacrificial death for all of us. And then He rose from the grave. So God keeps His promises. You know, this, I told Andy, it might not be my best sermon, but it was the easiest. And I want to tell you why real quick. It's because I didn't write this sermon. Those six kids in class did last week. I said to the students, I said, let's do an activity. I gave them their little whiteboards and I said, you tell me what lessons we can learn from the Israelites. And we recounted those first two slides, the whole history of the Israelites, from the promises made to Abraham all the way up to the Israelites going into the promised land. And then we paired them up and they batted around the ideas and then we collected them on the whiteboard. And you can see we had some similarities here. You just got to forgive my writing. Old teacher writing. Our children know these lessons. Do our adults? Does the world? And if not, they should. And tonight, if you're not a Christian, then we invite you to become one. Because we have every reason to believe. We have every reason to obey. And if you are a Christian and you've fallen away from God, You have every reason to believe, and you have every reason to come back and obey. This evening, if you're subject to the invitation, won't you come while we stand, while we sing?
I come, Jesus, I come into thy freedom, gladness, and light. Jesus, I come to thee out of my sickness, into thy I